Helen, why don't you just start back by recalling what sort of house you lived in, or where it was, things like that.
Let's just say I was born. I don't see why you can't do this.
Well, you don't see what you see.
I was born in a little four-room house in the country. The fourth child of my mother and father's, the oldest girl. And as far back as I can remember, we had a big wood stove and a big wood heater and a fireplace. And this is where we all got up our lessons around the big heater. We sit on the floor. And my chores was, the main chores was to take care of the children. And in the cooking, my job was to make bread 3 times a day. And we had a big barrel that we kept the flour in. And that's where I made the bread in the pantry. And I always built the fires in the cook stove. And we children brought in wood and packed beside of the stove and on the porch. And then as I grew older, my job was to milk the calf and help churn and wash and iron.
And what about your mother and father? What did they do?
My mother was the main one to watch after all the cooking and plan all the meals. And my father, he worked in the field with the boys. And he was a farmer. And my mother and father together run a set of looms in Dan River Cotton Mill under the supervision of Jim Copeland. And my father, he would run the looms in the winter time and go to and from work by horseback. And the horse would have to break the ice to swim across the creek. And in the summertime when he was farming, my mother run the looms, and she stayed in town because she couldn't ride the horse. And one day I was sitting in the wagon, and the cow jumped over top of me. I remember my brother telling me that. Now,
where did your mother stay when she stayed in Danville?
She stayed with a Miss
sister, Owen.
Mayhew on Belmont Avenue.
She was that a boarding house?
No, just a friend.
And she would stay there in the summertime?
Uh-huh. But, you know, just while the mill was running, then on the weekend she would come home. They'd go get her on the wagon or buggy. You can't remember those things, but I do.
Was it pretty unusual that a husband and wife would share a set of looms at that time? Maybe you know.
I don't know.
But they would let people do that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They let them do it. I don't guess, I don't know about other people.
Do you know anything about how your mother and father met? What about how they might have gotten their job at the mill? You know, how they first got their job? Then, I'm sorry, go ahead.
That thing doesn't pick up shaking your head.
I didn't want it.
Well,
I remember him saying that when he was a young man, that his brothers and sisters moved from North Carolina to Texas. And he stayed out there 2 or 3 years in Texas with them. And he was getting on up around 20 years old then. So he decided to come back to this part of the country. And so he rode a train, hoboed on the train back to Danville. And he went to work in the cotton mill there. And that's the way he got back to Danville. He hoboed back from Texas. His sister and brother moved out there, and he went with them as a young man. And he came back to Danville then. And got a job there in the mill, and I would think that was when they met.
Yes, they probably met in the mill.
That's right. And they he'd never seen his brother and sister in Texas anymore until 1938, and we taken him and Betty's mother out there to see his people again. They hadn't seen each other from, I think it was 1902 till 1938, and we take them back out there for a reunion with them.
Well, what about then, going back to when you all had time to go to school, your brothers and sisters?
We had to walk to a little school, two-room schoolhouse, about 4 miles through the snow and mud.
And would all of you be allowed to go? Did they want you to go to school?
We had to go to school.
Had mm-hmm. to go.
And we, in the two little rooms, they went from the Prima, we called it the Prima, through the eighth grade. And that's as far as we went, as far as I went.
And after, what about your other brothers and sisters? Did any of them go any further to school?
Yeah, high school. All the younger ones went through high school.
All the ones younger?
Younger than I was.
Why mm-hmm. didn't you go on?
I had to go to work.
Why was that?
So many children. And during the Depression.
So, where did you go to work?
Dan City Silk Mill.
Do you remember how it was that you came to get your first job?
Yes, a friend of mine, Ms. Eunice Barker. She lived close to us, and she got me the job and taught me to weave.
Did she already have a job?
Yeah, she was older than I was, and she was married.
I see.
And she taught me to weave.
And
she just passed away about 2 years ago.
And when you were learning to weave, were you being paid to learn?
No.
How did that work?
You got a job, and until you went on looms, you didn't make anything.
Well, how would you learn to weave? How would that work? When would you get the time? You just stand there and watch her?
Well, she'd take me with her on the job. And we only had 2 and 4 looms. No dry ice. So you had to watch the work all together. And we run pure silk and Georgette silk.
And she would teach you, and then sometimes she'd let you
start the looms up. Mm-hmm.
And how long did that go on before you got a job? How long was she teaching you?
A month.
At least
a month. But everybody learned on their own. They didn't pay you.
Okay, and then we can go along kind of generally. How long did you stay there at that job?
About 2 years. And the mill closed down. That was when we came to Burlington, March 21st, 1932.
Why the mill closed? Any idea?
Just
everything's closed at those times, just about.
It was during the Depression.
Okay. So, then you came to Burlington.
Uh-huh.
And why don't you tell the story that you told a while ago about how it was that you all were able to.
Well, she and I were dating, and both worked at this silk mill, and along with several other people we knew. So we were all out, got out with it when the mill closed. We were all out of work at the same time. So her father, Dave's father, told us, says, why don't y'all get Vernell, her brother, why don't you get Vernell to take you to Burlington? Look up Mr. Copeland. And says, tell him I sent you, and then you folks are out of work and you need work. So we got Betty's brother to bring us down here, and we went to several mills till we found Mr. Copeland was. So we went in the weave room and asked him if we could see Mr. Copeland, and they went and got Mr. Copeland and brought him down, and he showed us around over the mill, and then he told the overseers that these were people that he knew from Danville that they were out of work and needed work, and see what he could do for them. And so they said they could put one to work. So I taken the job, and Betty and the other couple, they went back to Danville, and they came back in about 2 weeks, and they put Betty and this other lady to work. And I went to work on the third shift, and Betty went to work on the first shift, and the other lady, when she came back, she went to work on the third shift. So that was out of the start of our working at Plaid Mill.
And now, how was it that you all knew Mr. Copeland?
Her father worked for Mr. Copeland in Danville, and he was a good friend of Mr. Copeland, so he told us to come down here. He didn't know where he was, but he was in Burlington, to come down to come to Burlington and then look him up and see if he could help us any. So so all four of us came, but only one of us got a job that day, and I taken it and went to Plaid Mill boarding house and got a boarding place. And I think it was about 2 weeks later that Betty and this other lady came back, and they got a job then. But the other young man, he went to Reedville and found a job. He never did get a job at Plaid Mill or anywhere in Burl. So that's the way we got started here, and that was in March of 32, and then we were married in January of 33.
Now, where did you stay before you all were married and while you were working in the mill?
He's Hattie Denny on Plaid Street.
Hattie Denny?
Hattie Denny.
Mm-hmm. She had a boarding house?
She run a boarding house for Plaid Mill.
Uh-huh. Now, who all would be there? Would it just be men or
men
women?
Men and women.
Mm-hmm. How large a place was this?
She had about 15 people probably. It was some couples, man and wife, but most of them were single people. And she had two to four to a room. And it was only two blocks from the mill, but she was very strict. He was really grilled before she would even consider taking you because she was very strict.
Did you live at the same place?
We both, uh-huh. after she came and stayed with the Vaughns for a few weeks, and then her and this Sadie, the other lady, both came there and roomed together. And so we lived there. We was living there, boarding there when we got married. And we got married and got a little apartment right across the street. Right on this street, right behind our house now.
What's the name of that street?
Askew. So we've lived right in this, within the 5 blocks of Plaid Mill all that time. Right around the different places. West Webb and Ava Street, Askew Street. Of course, now we're still on the corner of Askew Street.
What do you remember about how you all met?
We were both working at Dan City Sick Mill, and that's how we met. He was on the third shift, and I was on the first shift.
Well, actually, it was just day shift and night shift, really, because it was 10 hours a day shift and 12 hours night shift.
Well, how could you meet if one of you was coming on one time and the other one was coming on at another time?
Well, I think this... We dated on the weekend. That's the only chance you had working those hours. And this friend of hers, I got her to get a date with Betty, and I got her a date with my friend. So that was the first date we had together. And so Betty and I must have hit it off pretty good because we kept dating, but I don't think the other couple did. But we dated on... As long as we were there, she would stay in town with this other lady I spoke about. She would stay in town in the wintertime because the road was so bad because she couldn't get back in and out at home. And in the summertime, she would stay at home because the road, she only lived 2 miles from town. So it was out in the country. Now it's part of town, but it was out in the country then, farming. But, we dated until we came to Burlington. Then we was married about a year after we came to Burlington.
Well, what would you all do on dates, say in Danville?
Play brick trollers. About all you had to do. Play records.
Who had a record player?
Well, the lady she boarded with during the winter, they had one, and that's about all you could do. Go walk to the drugstore.
Do you remember any of the songs that you heard back then?
Yeah, they are so old, I don't remember.
How long did that go on then? That was y'all's courting time.
Well, it was about, I reckon, 6 months in Dan before the mill closed down. Maybe a year after we started dating till the mill closed down. And we was here almost a year before we was married.
Okay, so then you came on and you worked there at the flat mill for still till it closed down. So.
Mm-hmm.
And you stopped work, when was it, in
1956. I left the mill and went to work for Melville Dairy, and I worked there until I retired, end of 74. Well, it changed hands, management, 2 or 3 times, but still the same people. So I worked there. I run a route for about 8 years, and I went on a supervisor's job, and I run a supervisor's job until I retired for about 10, 11 years, I guess. But my health got so bad that I had to retire earlier than I really planned to.
Was it related anyway to your work, occupational health?
Probably some of it was. I had a lot of disc trouble, and I think that probably related to it, but otherwise, I think that was all. That was my first health problem.
How would the disc trouble have been?
By lifting. You're lifting cases of milk, and loading trucks, unloading trucks. But at one time it wouldn't be so much, but you did it over and over and over, and I think that over a period of time is really what caused it.
And you were a weaver then, all of this?
I've always was. Mm-hmm.
And did you like that? Or?
I loved it.
You really did?
Mm-hmm. I still love it.
Evidently she does, because I can't keep her at home.
So you've seen a lot of different changes in...
Oh, so many.
Is there any way you can think back on some of those changes, maybe in your work, the way, the pace, how things used to be as compared to what they became?
Well, when I went to work, I was only running 2 looms, and then I went to 4 looms, then I went to 6 looms. Then we went to 8, and then on, it was according to whatever styles was on.
Do you remember about when it was you went from 2 to 4 or to 8? Years and about.
You went to about 6 when you came to Burlington.
Yes.
From pure silk to rayon, you went from 4 loom to 6. And then it's been gradually climbing ever since as you modernize, you know. back then, you'd fill your own shuttle, you know, and put in a lot of your breakouts and all those things. But eventually went to magazines, you know, and shuttle change looms. Then they got battery fillers, shuttle fillers. So that just give you more and more looms to look after. But you had battery fillers to fill the batteries, and you didn't have to do that. Then you went to a cloth doffers. You had to take off all the cloth, you know, as you got a roll finished while someone taking that off. So you went more to just weaving. Before, at first, you did it all. You did your battery filling, you did your taking off cloth, you did your smashing, and all these things. But as you modernize, why, you just take more looms and taking off a lot of the other work you had to do in that. When I left the mill in 56, I believe it was, I was running, I think, 35 looms, and I went from 2 to 35 over that period of time. And now I think she'll run probably anywhere from 75 to 100. So it's through modernization, and she's running looms now that I've never even seen, such as push-button looms. And some of the modern looms I've never seen. I mean, it was still shuttle chains when I came out in 56, but now it's bobbin chains. I think they have looms that don't even have shuttles now. It's just, they call them shuttleless looms. I've never seen them, but that has changed over the years.
Well, what about your parents? Did they like their work in the mill?
Yeah, my father and mother both love weaving. And the ones that fix looms love fixing looms.
And did they ever say anything about their work that you remember particularly?
No, they just liked it. And then my father liked farming. And I think it's real interesting back now. My father worked for Mr. Jim Copeland in Danville. And then I came to Burlington and hunted him up and told him I was Johnny Parker's daughter, and he gave me a job. And I worked for him at Plaid Mill all those many years, and then retired. And now I'm working for his great-grandson, right? Four generations.
Grandson.
Three generations. And I'm still working for Copeland.
Did you ever think about going into any other kind of work?
Mm-mm. I never did want to do anything.
Is that right?
I just love weaving. It's real interesting. You learn so many different things.
What about the time that you might have, the hours, how the hours changed since the time?
Not too much.
Really?
No. Now, when we first came to Burlington, weren't we on?
We were on 8 hours
then.
Now, some of the back when we came to Plaid Mill, they had belt looms. I don't know if you've ever heard of belt looms or not, running by belts. We was in the newest section at the had had the motors on the looms and run by motor. But some of the older part of the mill was still running belt looms, and they was working 12 hours a day. And that was two shifts. But we went to work in on the newer type looms, and they was running three shifts, 8 hours. So when we came to Burlington, we actually started on an 8 hour, just like it is now. But there was some of the mill that was still on 12 hours and on belt looms. I never run a belt loom, but there was still some of them there. They took them out a few years after that, and went to all battery looms.
Burlington did not yet bought the Plaid Mill when you walked in.
No, it was the E.M. Hull Plaid Mill. And Mr. Lynn Williamson was one of the main owners, I guess. And Mr. Walter Williams was the superintendent, and Mr. C.D. Gaddis was the office manager, and Clo Fowler was the payroll clerk. He looked after all the payrolls, timekeeping. Because back then you didn't have 100 or so in your office with all your social securities and all your government programs, you know. You run your own business then.
You were saying that when you all first went there to get a job, you went right to the...
You go right to the weave room and talk to the weave room overseer of the weave room bosses.
And each section of the mill, the person who was the supervisor in that part...
They were set up that you had a weave room overseer. It was over all the weave room. But you had, they called second hands. But they were under him. And either one could hire you. But you went and talked to those. You talked direct to the man that you was going to work for. You didn't go through any personnel office or anything like that type. You went direct to the man you worked for. And now, the way it is now, you have a seniority system. You know, you go to work on the third shift and gradually work as your seniority builds gradually. Work yourself up to the first shift job. But back then, you went to work on a shift that the man could use you on, wherever he needed a weaver. So you went direct to the man you worked for, and you didn't have to go through anyone else to get in touch with him, he went right in the mill and told the man that you were looking for work.
Who was the person that would have been your supervisor first? Do you remember?
Mr. George Gregg.
What do you remember about him?
Just a fine, great, big, gray-headed man.
What was his job? What would he have done day to day? How would he have worked?
Well, when we would go in, see, we didn't have a job. You'd just go stand on the floor, and whoever was out, and he'd come and get you and put you on that job. And he was just your boss man, you know.
I'm not sure I quite understand why you would be, when you wouldn't have a job and he would come and get you and put you on one.
Well, you see, we'd just stand in the middle of the floor up here at the front.
Normally, when you go to work at a place like that, maybe you don't get a full-time job. You may not work every day. You go in and stand on the spare floor, and if he can use you that day, wherever he can use you, he come and get you and say, come on, and he'll take you to the job where he can use you at. And if he can't use you, he'll say, well, we don't have anything today. There's nobody out, and we don't have anything today, so you just have to wait and come back tomorrow.
So how long did you have to do that before you actually got a full-time job?
I believe, I can't say, I know I run several people's looms before I ever got a set of my own. You would run looms as whoever was out. I can remember the man at the first set of looms I ever run, and I still know who the man was. It was out that he got off that night, and for some reason, and so I run his looms. And I remember that was the first set I ever run. And then we now run different ones until an opening came to give you a set of looms.
So you would have to go, even though you would be hired as a weaver, you'd have to go and kind of work your way into the...
You'd have to take a spare job, and they call it a spare hand in those days. And it might be a week or it might be a month or two before they'd have an open for a full-time job, and you just take what spare work you could get.
Would you still be, say you were learning from this woman how to weave, would you still be doing that if you came to work and they told you that day you couldn't, they didn't have anything for you, would you stay around the mill or would you go home or would you stay and learn some more about weaving or what would you do?
Well, after I was qualified as a weaver, I just go on back home.
I see.
Because, see, I wasn't making anything. And after I learned, you see, you're supposed to make your pay.
What time of day would you go over there?
We went to work at 7, got off at 3.
So, and you would know within a few minutes or an hour or so whether or not you're going to get to work at
it. As soon as they placed all the help, they'd know whether they had anyone out or anyone that wanted to be off that day. See, if they may have someone come in and say, I'd like to be off today. Well, then that'd give you a chance to get a day's work there. But he would check all his help and see if all his help was there. He had no one out or no one wanted to be off. Well, then he'd say, well, we don't have anything today, so you just go back home because you're not making anything if you're not running looms that day.
It's not that way now. You see, you go in, you want a job. And they pay you to learn now.
And you have no spare help now, you know.
When did that change?
Well, it changed over the years. One thing that caused it to change like that, back then, if you went up there and they didn't have it for you, it didn't cost them anything. But now, if you go in, they've got to pay you at least 2 hours' work, you know. So they just don't have spare help to come in every day because it's cost now. But back then, you was more or less on your own. You went in on your own and hoping you'd get some work.
We leave here real early Saturday morning, get up there about noon, and we'd have all the afternoon to sightsee, spend the night, and come back down through the valley on Sunday. It was a real good trip. And we'd go to, we used to go deep sea fishing right much. That was another good sport.
Back before World War II?
Yeah.
Is that right? Where would you go?
We'd go to Moorhead mostly. About get about three or four couples. you could rent a boat for $25 then and split it up four ways, you know, you could afford it. So
what are some other things that you would do?
Well, that's mostly what we did, was going deep sea fishing, going to the mountain.
Where would you go to in the mountains?
Well, mostly to Asheville.
Mm-hmm. And what could you do there in Asheville?
Well, just go drive up and back,
yeah.
See the mountains. It wasn't a whole lot to do. We didn't have all this these modern things, you know, like skiing and...
Well, that sounds like a good bit, though, to go to Washington.
Sky lifts and things like that. We didn't have all those things then, you know.
Did you all ever go to any ball games of any kind?
Oh, I went every chance I had.
What kind?
Well, semi-pro.
Baseball?
Yeah. And football. Of course, just the football then, you know, we didn't have anything with Broad Street High School. And you go over here to Hillcrest, and wherever they played at, and just walk up down the sidelines with them, you know. Maybe you'd have 100 or 2 people there, or 200 was a good crowd. Didn't cost you anything to get in. You just go over and watch them walk up down the sideline. As they went from one end of the field to the other, the crowd would go with them. You didn't have these stadiums like you have now, you know, with all these conveniences.
Do you remember any boxing matches, anything like that?
Well, we used to have wrestling down to City Hall. That was the only indoor place they had for any kind of sports.
This would have been back before World War II?
Before World War II. They'd have wrestling matches at City Hall.
Did you go to the wrestling matches too?
Only thing I went to was boating. I used to like to bowl.
Oh, really? When could you first start bowling? When was that?
They had bowling alleys here when we came to Burlington.
Is that right?
And I bowled a lot. She bowled right much.
How often would you go bowling?
Maybe 2 or 3 times a week. And I had a Sunday school class, and they would let us take the children bowling. Mm-hmm. We really enjoyed it.
You would go at night after work?
After work, at night.
How big of a place was it, the bowling alley? Several lanes?
Well, they had one on Main Street upstairs. I think it had 8 alleys. Then they moved around on in the old Chevrolet building. And I believe there was 12 alleys there. So bowling was a real good sport then.
It was real
and her
popular.
Father was a great bowler. And I reckon that she probably liked it from watching him bowl.
When did he start to bowl? Was he bowling in Danville?
I don't know when he started, but he bowled till he was in his 80s. He was 89 when he died, and he bowled till just a few years before he died.
That was
and he was real good at it.
Uh-huh. This was popular among people.
It was a real good sport. You know, you didn't have too much to choose from. Well, ball games and bowling. And pool rooms, that's just about the extent of it.
What about the movies? Did you all go to any picture
well,
shows?
Well, we used to go some. We've never been much of a movie fan.
Let me go back to when you all first came here and were living in the boarding house, Miss Denny's boarding house. Okay. Would she cook the food there, or have somebody work
she had her? She had maids, colored maids, and of course she helped. She more or less supervised and kept things in order. She was very strict.
How many would people eat there who didn't live in the boarding house?
No, it was just the people that were there, but she usually had about I'd say from 12 to 14 to 15, about all the time.
Do you remember, maybe you would remember this, what some of the food she cooked or that you all had at the boarding house?
It was all good. I don't remember just what. Uh-huh.
What time of day would your meals be? Was it the same time every day?
Yes, same time.
You had set time. Of course, sometimes you had to stagger that because people back they were starting to work then around the clock, you know, all three shifts. You know, you used to just have two shifts, day and night, but then you start going to 8-hour shifts, and you had to arrange your meals kind of to take care of the whole shift.
There were, seemed to be a lot of boarding houses in Burlington.
Well, that a lot of people lived at boarding houses, and there was a lot of single people that stay at boarding houses. You didn't have motels, and about all the single people had to stay at a boarding house.
Was Miss Denny married?
She was a widow.
And do you know?
Her son and daughter lived with her. They wasn't married. Well, I said they was married. Her son and I roomed together. Betty and the lady he married, girl he married, they roomed together. So when we got married, Betty came in the room I was in, and he went in the room she was in. So we just, we was next rooms. So we got married at the same time. Because we didn't live there very long after we were married. We got us an apartment and started keeping out. But
did she start that boarding house after her husband had died?
She was running it when we came to Burlington. Her husband got killed a long time before that, I think. Got killed on construction work, I think. She'd been a widow a good while then, I think.
Could it have been that she began this after he died?
Probably so.
Maybe one way to get it at the some of the changes in the mill life would be to start by remembering how a particular kind of activities changed. For instance, when you all came in the 1930s to work, how much time would you have out for lunch in the Plaid Mill?
Well, some of Plaid Mill was running three shifts, and some of it was running two shifts. The part of the mill that was running three shifts, you didn't get a break for lunch. I mean, it was 8-hour shifts around the clock. But the part that was running two shifts, they'd get a lunch break, probably an hour, because I think they worked 10-hour shifts, mm-hmm. and then maybe an hour for lunch. But it was going into an 8-hour day, and when we came here, some of the mill was already on an 8-hour day. So, you know, 8-hour day, that's around the clock when you have three shifts.
So you didn't have any time out for lunch on an 8-hour?
You eat as you work. You had to take your lunch if you had anything to eat. And they did, though, in later years have a commissary truck that came around that you could get drinks and sandwiches and things off of.
Well, how could you eat as you worked?
Well, sometimes you'd start up several looms before you'd finish. You'd eat. You'd start up two or three machines, and you'd eat a little, and then you'd, after you started up two or three machines, you'd eat some more. And you just had to work your eating in with your work.
Would you have a few minutes in between starting up your looms?
Well, you just have to stop eating, and to start up looms, stop starting up looms to eat.
I see.
You just you had to work it in with your work. You did it. You couldn't take any time to mount anything for eating, because you'd have to eat and work at the same time. That's if you'd ever eat lunch with us, you'd probably understand it better, because if we sit down to eat, we just eat just like we don't have but about a minute to eat in, you know. And it's real embarrassing, but you don't get out of the habit. Just like I play golf. I used to work third shift and play golf of a morning. Well, I'd go to golf course, and I'd almost run to get through, get back when I was working third shift, get back to go to bed. And I'm still that way on the golf course. I go out there now, I think you got to be through in a couple of hours or so, you know. You can't readjust. Once you set your pace like that, you don't readjust. You just
you still stay in that same pattern. I mean, it's hard to.
Well, were there people who couldn't adjust to that routine?
Well, I don't know. I couldn't. Well, we couldn't because Betty and I, when we go out and eat with people, we are embarrassed still at the way we eat. We're through and sitting there waiting, and the other people are just getting into the meal. But you just, I think you're just getting that routine, and it's hard to get out of it.
Well, what about people who were working in the meal? Were there some people that while they were there in the meal, just couldn't get used to working at that pace or keeping up?
Well, the ones that are on production, that's the way they work. Now, everybody wasn't on production. You had people that wasn't on production. Well, they could take a break and eat. But when you're on production, you figure every time you got a loom standing, you're losing money. You know, and that's to keeping the machine to running. So it's a difference in being on production and being on hourly work. You pace yourself different. In fact, you work a lot harder as a rule on the production than you do on the hourly work.
What was the kind of work that was going on then in the time, in the 1930s? Was it mostly production?
Well, all your weaving was production. But you had loom fixers and other people, warp hands and smash hands, and all those people was hourly wages. But your weavers was on production. Now your weavers and loom fixers both on production. They pay you now, they say, according to how much work machines turn out, and the weavers and loom fixers too are paid that way. But back when I was working in a mill, the weaver was on the one on production, and he was fighting it all the time too. Well, in fact, you were pushed to get production, and you were also pushing yourself to get it and to make all that you could.
What sort of stress and strains would that produce in people?
Well, it depends on how much, I guess you might say, drive you had in trying to make money. If you didn't have too much desire and drive to try to make all you could, why, you didn't have to work that hard, but the company still pushed you to get production.
Would there be people who would kind of pace themselves at a slower pace?
Well, everybody is different, you know. I mean, two people on a job side by side, one will work faster than the other. It's just your nature.
Would there be
She's much faster than I am because she works in a hurry all the time. I don't. I try to take my time all I can, but she always works in a hurry.
Would there be any feeling that you could lose your job if you didn't keep up?
Well, you could. You had to get production. I mean, that was a must, is to get production. Now, maybe you just barely get it, or if you was real fast and worked harder at it, you could go on and make more. But you was required to get production. If you couldn't, why, you'd eventually be replaced.
How would they set the amount of work that you had to do?
Well, they have time study people that study how much of a loom is supposed to run in 8 hours, and you expected to run that much.
Did that change, say, in the 20s and 30s?
That's still changing. Only thing now that, of course, I haven't been in the mill in a number of years, but the only thing now is the machines have been speeded up. They run much faster, and you run a lot more machines too.
Would it be true that you weren't pushing yourself quite as far? It's hard back in the earlier days.
Well, you probably wasn't pushing yourself as hard, and you wasn't pushed as hard by the company. I mean, you were pushed, but not, I guess you'd say, to the extreme like you are now. You got, now you have too many people pushing the pencil behind you. And everyone's pushing that pencil is pushing you too. So you got all M&S and men and all that, you know. And the,
what's that stand?
Method and standard. Now I haven't seen, I'm behind too. I haven't worked in the mill in 25 years, you know. But now they'll stand there and figure how long it takes you to tie a knot, how long it takes you to draw that thread in after you tie the knot, and all of they've got it down now to fractions almost.
Were they doing any of that when you came?
They didn't start that till about the time out a while before I came out of the mill. But
do you remember some of the first people that would have been those sort of people that came into the mill to look? Would they look at what you're doing, or in the 30s, or?
No, not then. They wasn't that. They didn't push that much then. They pushed too, but they just pushed by talking to you or urging you and telling you you'd have to get more production. But now they push you and then prove it to you.
What about any effects on people's health that might have had?
Well, I don't know. That'd be hard to say. You know, most of the people back in the older times live a lot longer than they do now, so I don't know whether these modern conveniences and all this technology is helping us any or not. Just like my father lived to be 82, her father lived to be 89, and they didn't push themselves like people do now, you know. So I think that maybe it's, you have some advantage and some disadvantage with all this modern technology.
Were there any cases in which folks who were working in the mills were unhappy at all with their circumstance, or would do anything to?
Well, if you ever seen a group of people that everybody was happy. Well, there's always somebody dissatisfied, regardless of the circumstances.
Well, people keep telling us how much they liked, you know, working and doing these jobs, but there must have been.
Well, you always got somebody a bitching too.
Yeah. Well, why? What would be?
Well, there's some people you can't please. I don't care if you give them a moon, they'd want the sun too. So some people you can't please. So a lot of time it's not because they wasn't getting a fair shake. After they got a fair shake, they still wasn't happy. You see what I mean? Some people can be satisfied and contented with a lot less than others. I mean, that's just nature, I think.
Well, now, there was that one time that in the Platte mill where there was some trouble that we've heard about, you know, on several occasions, that famous dynamite.
Go to court about that.
Mm-hmm. Could you talk some about what you remember about that?
Well, really, we would go to Danville about every week. We'd go over to her parents in Danville, and there were several people from Danville that was working at Platte Mill and other mills here in Burlington. Mm-hmm. And we'd go home every week. Mr. DeLong, he lived in Danville for years and years and worked over here, and he'd go home every week. And we rode with him a long time, a lot of weekends. We didn't go every week, but a lot of weekends. But after we got a car of our own and started going on our own, we were going to Danville this weekend, and the lady that came with Betty and I to Burlington when we came over here, she says she was going with us, and she told us, said this, can't think of the man's name now, said he wanted to go ride with us to Danville too. So he went with us, and we went on Friday evening after we got out of work and came back Sunday evening. Well, Saturday morning is when the meal was dynamited. That was during this strike. I don't remember, I believe they struck at that time. But anyway, well, this man had went with us to Danville. Well, eventually one that was charged with dynamiting the mill. So when he came to trial, he had me for a witness to try to prove that he wasn't in Burlington on that weekend, that he was in Danville. So I had to go to court and testify that he went with rode with us to Danville on Friday and came back Sunday. I couldn't say what he did during that time because I didn't see him, but I was a witness to verify that he went with us to Danville and on Friday and came back Sunday. So it was a lot of ill will during those things. You know, they bring on a lot of ill will.
But he was convicted?
I'm not sure. I believe he was. I believe he was. It seemed like he got two years for that. I'm not sure.
They figured he came back in?
Evidently they, you could very easily come back to Burlington in an hour or so, you know. And that wasn't enough evidence to prove that he wasn't here, because he went Friday and this was did Saturday morning and he came back Sunday. So, of course, I was a witness to try to help him prove that he wasn't here, but evidently it wasn't enough evidence. And they may have had other evidence too.
Well, what were the reasons why that would have led them to do something like that?
Well, I really don't remember now, but you still have those things to happen now when you have a strike, you know. You read, well, there's shooting and dynamiting, and especially on these truck drivers and things, you know, going in and out of plants. You still have that. Anytime you have a strike and all, if it lasts very long, you're going to have some trouble and violence along with it.
Well, what was the cause of the strike to begin with?
Well, just like it's always been, I guess, better working conditions and more money. And they felt like if they could force the company to give them more money and better working conditions.
Because
that's just like I said a while ago about people being satisfied. You can't give anybody enough to satisfy them, because if you give them one thing, they're going to want two things, and it's just a snowballing thing. But it's the working conditions, and sometimes they do get bad enough you just have to do something to try to better the condition.
About how many of the folks who were in the mill at that time were in support of that strike?
I couldn't really say. It was some that worked us all the time. I mean, it wasn't 100%. And that's where your bad feelings and your violence comes in. People going through, some out to the gate of picketing, and then people come going in and coming out, you know, and that's when it gets real nasty. You know, back then, everybody was out on strike. Just about it would be at the gates. But now, you know, you're limited to so many can pick it. But back then, you were on your own. Everybody that wanted to come to the gates and pick it and throw slurs and everything else at the ones that were working while they did. And sometime it just got real nasty. But I think that strike lasted about maybe two or three weeks, something like that.
Well, what did you all do during this time?
We stayed out of work about, I think we stayed out a week. And, of course, we was young and we didn't know probably what to do, but I think we stayed out about a week. And we'd seen it. We were just losing time, and it wasn't going to amount to anything, really. We wasn't going to get anything out of it, so we went back to work.
Did you all ever come out on the picket line?
We, most of the time, we would stay at home. We could stay at home and see just about, about 2 blocks from the mill. You could just about see what was going on at the mill. And we didn't get involved in it too much.
Well, now, who would have been the people who organized or tried to organize that strike?
I don't remember who it was. I think it was American Federation of Labor was about the only all we had. We didn't have the CIO and all these. I don't know that how many of them is now, but we did. It wasn't but one labor organization in there. And, of course, I think this was more or less a local thing anyway.
Were there particular people who were here in the working in the mill who were the trying to get the union going, or were people sent in from outside?
I think it was mostly local, just trying to get the people to go together and try to get something done. But you don't, your chances are real slim on something like that, because as a rule, the people working can, most of the people was more or less a week to week, a payday to payday thing, and you can't stay out very long. Mm-hmm. In other words, the company can stand it a lot longer than you can, so they just break you down.
Did that happen some in this case?
I think we stayed out about 2 or 3 weeks, but we wasn't out long enough to be in a big thing. Now, they had a strike in Danville before we came to Burlington back about 1930. And that thing went on for about a year, and they stuck it out a long time, but I think the company finally forced them back to work. But they've got the upper hand. Of course, now you've got your labor organizations that if you have a strike here, that the labor organizations will give support to you while you're out. But back then, you were just on your own. You were just losing time, that was all. And you couldn't stand to lose time very long when you were just making barely a living wage anyway.
Were there any meetings of all those people that would have been out on the strike? Would they get together and try to plan some
strategy?
Oh, yeah,
they had meetings and all. And
where would they be held?
I don't really remember now, but you didn't have, as a rule, you didn't have two intelligent people leading those things. A lot of times you just had your loudmouth people. They had more mouth than they had intelligence. You didn't usually think you didn't have very good leadership.
Well, what happened then after the strike was over? Did the people that were involved in it, the strikers, any of them come back to work in the mill?
Most of them did. Some of them they wouldn't take back, more or less the leaders and all. Some of them they wouldn't take back, but most of the people went back to work. And you didn't accomplish anything, really.
And did their hard feelings remain?
Well, yeah, that creates hard feelings. So even from a one worker to another, you know. Like, you come out and I stay in. Well, you are scared and everything else, you know, if you keep working and you're not helping, trying to help us better the conditions and all, you know. And that's where your hard feelings come in. It can get real nasty. A lot of people will get mad because the other person don't agree with them, you know. But was they right and you're wrong, and they get mad because they think you're wrong.
We leave here real early Saturday morning, get up there about noon, and we'd have all the afternoon to sightsee, spend the night, and come back down through the valley on Sunday. It was a real good trip. And we used to go deep sea fishing right much, That's another good sport.
Back before World War II?
Yeah.
Is that right? Where would you go?
We'd go to Moorhead mostly. Get about three or four couples. You could rent a boat for $25 then and split it up four ways, you know, you could afford it.
So what are some other things that you would do?
Well, that's mostly what we did, was going deep sea fishing, going to the mountain.
Where would you go to in the mountains?
Well, mostly to Asheville.
Mm-hmm. And what could you do there in Asheville?
Well, just go drive up and back,
yeah.
See the mountains. There wasn't a whole lot to do. We didn't have all this, these modern things, you know, like skiing and...
Well, that sounds like a good bit, though, to go to Washington.
Sky lifts and things like that. We didn't have all those things then, you know.
Did you all ever go to any ball games of any kind?
Oh, I went every chance I had.
What kind?
Well, semi-pro.
Baseball?
Yeah. And football. Of course, just the football then, you know, we didn't have anything with Broad Street High School. And you go over here to Hillcrest, and wherever they played at, and just walk up down the sidelines with them, you know. Maybe you'd have 100 or 2 people there, or 200 was a good crowd. Didn't cost you anything to get in. You just go over and watch them walk up down the sideline. As they went from one end of the field to the other, the crowd would go with them. You didn't have these stadiums like you have now, you know, with all these conveniences.
Do you remember any boxing matches, anything like that?
Well, we used to have wrestling down to City Hall. That was the only indoor place they had for any kind of sports.
And this would have been back before World War II?
Before World War II. They'd have wrestling matches at City Hall.
Did you go to the wrestling matches too?
Only thing I went to was boating. I used to like to bowl.
Oh, really? When could you first start bowling? When was that?
They had bowling out here when we came to Burlington.
Is that right?
And I bowled a lot. She bowled right much.
How often would you go bowling?
Maybe 2 or 3 times a week. And I had a Sunday school class, and they would let us take the children bowling. Mm-hmm. We really enjoyed it.
You would go at night after work?
After work, at night.
How big of a place was it, the bowling alley? Several lanes?
Well, they had one on Main Street upstairs. I think it had 8 alleys. Then they moved around on in the old Chevrolet building, and I believe there was 12 alleys there. So bowling was a real good sport then.
It was real
and her
popular.
Father was he was a great bowler, and I reckon that she probably liked it from watching him bowl.
When did he start to bowl? Was he bowling in Danville?
I don't know when he started, but he bowled till he was in his 80s. He was 89 when he died, and he bowled just a few years before he died.
That was a
and
real,
he was real good at it.
Uh-huh. This was popular among people.
It was a real good sport. You know, you didn't have too much to choose from. Well, ball games and bowling and pool rooms, that's just about the extent of it.
What about the movies? Did you all go to any picture
well,
shows?
Well, we used to go some. We've never been much of a movie fan.
Let me go back to when you all first came here and were living in the boarding house, Miss Denny's boarding
yeah.
house. Okay. Would she cook the food there or have somebody work
She had she had maids, colored maids, and of course she helped. She more or less supervised and kept things in order. She was very strict.
How many would people eat there who didn't live in the boarding house?
No, it was just the people that were there. But she usually had about I'd say from 12 to 14 to 15 about all the time.
Do you remember? Maybe you would remember this. What some of the food she cooked or that you all had at the boarding house?
It was all good. I don't remember just what.
Uh-huh. What time of day would your meals be? Was it the same time every day?
Yes, same time.
You had to set time. Of course, sometimes you had to stagger that because people, back, they were starting to work then around the clock, you know, all three shifts. You know, you used to just have two shifts, day and night, but then you start going to 8-hour shifts, and you had to arrange your meals kind of to take care of the whole shift.
There seemed to be a lot of boarding houses in Burlington.
Well, that a lot of people lived at boarding houses, and there was a lot of single people that stay at boarding houses. You didn't have motels, and about all the single people had to stay at a boarding house.
Was Miss Denny married?
She was a widow.
And do you know?
Her son and daughter lived with her. They wasn't married. Well, I said they was married. Her son and I roomed together. Betty and the lady he married, girl he married, they roomed together. So when we got married, Betty came in the room I was in, and he went in the room she was in. So we just, we was next rooms. So we got married at the same time. Because we didn't live there very long after we were married. We got us an apartment and started keeping out. But
did she start that boarding house after her husband had died?
She was running it when we came to Burlington. Her husband got killed a long time before that, I think. Got killed on construction work, I think. She'd been a widow a good while then, I think.
Could it have been that she began this after he died?
Probably so.
Maybe one way to get it at the some of the changes in the mill life would be to start by remembering how a particular kind of activities changed. For instance, when you all came in the 1930s to work, how much time would you have out for lunch in the Plaid Mill?
Well, some of Plaid Mill was running three shifts, and some of it was running two shifts. The part of the mill that was running three shifts, you didn't get a break for lunch. I mean, it was 8-hour shifts around the clock. But the part that was running two shifts, they'd get a lunch break, probably an hour, because I think they worked 10-hour shifts, and then maybe an hour for lunch. But it was going into an 8-hour day, and when we came here, some of the mill was already on an 8-hour day. So, you know, 8-hour day, that's around the clock when you have three shifts.
So you didn't have any time out for lunch on an 8-hour?
You eat as you work. You had to take your lunch if you had anything to eat. And they did, though, in later years have a commissary truck that came around that you could get drinks and sandwiches and things off of.
Well, how could you eat as you worked?
Well, sometimes you'd start up several looms before you'd finish. You'd eat, you'd start up two or three machines, and you'd eat a little, and then you'd, after you started up two or three machines, you'd eat some more. And you just had to work your eating in with your work.
Would you have a few minutes in between starting up your looms?
Well, you just have to stop eating, and to start up looms, stop starting up looms to eat.
I see.
You just you had to work it in with your work. You did. You couldn't take any time to mount anything for eating, because you'd have to eat and work at the same time. That's if you'd ever eat lunch with us, you'd probably understand it better, because if we sit down to eat, we just eat just like we don't have but about a minute to eat in, you know. And it's real embarrassing, but you don't get out of the habit. Just like I play golf. I used to work third shift and play golf of a morning. Well, I'd go to golf course, and I'd almost run to get through, get back to when I was working third shift, get back to go to bed.
And I'm still that way on the golf course. I go out there now, I think you got to be through in a couple of hours or so, you know. You can't readjust. Once you set your pace like that, you don't readjust. You still stay in that same pattern. I mean, it's hard to.
Well, were there people who couldn't adjust to that routine?
Well, I don't know. I couldn't. Well, we couldn't because Betty and I, when we go out and eat with people, we are embarrassed still at the way we eat. We're through and sitting there waiting, and the other people are just getting into the meal. But you just, I think you're just getting that routine, and it's hard to get out of it.
Well, what about people who were working in the meal? Were there some people that while they were there in the meal, just couldn't get used to working at that pace or keeping up?
Well, the ones that are on production, that's the way they work. Now, everybody wasn't on production. You had people that wasn't on production. Well, they could take a break and eat. But when you're on production, you figure every time you got a loom standing, you're losing money. You know, and that's to keeping the machine to running. So it's a difference in being on production and being on hourly work. You pace yourself different. In fact, you work a lot harder as a rule on the production than you do on the hourly work.
What was the kind of work that was going on then in the time, in the 1930s? Was it mostly production?
Well, all your weaving was production. But you had loom fixers and other people, warp hands and smash hands, and all those people was hourly wages. But your weavers was on production. Now your weavers and loom fixers both on production. They pay you now, they say, according to how much work machines turn out, and the weavers and loom fixers too are paid that way. But back when I was working in a mill, the weaver was on the one on production, and he was fighting it all the time too. Well, in fact, you were pushed to get production, and you were also pushing yourself to get it and to make all that you could.
What sort of stress and strains would that produce in people?
Well, it depends on how much, I guess you might say, drive you had in trying to make money. If you didn't have too much desire and drive to try to make all you could, why, you didn't have to work that hard, but the company still pushed you to get production.
Would there be people who would kind of pace themselves at a slower pace?
Well, everybody is different, you know. I mean, two people on a job side by side, one will work faster than the other. It's just your nature.
Would there be
She's much faster than I am because she works in a hurry all the time. I don't. I try to take my time all I can, but she always works in a hurry.
Would there be any feeling that you could lose your job if you didn't keep up?
Well, you could. You had to get production. I mean, that was a must, is to get production. Now, maybe you just barely get it, or if you was real fast and worked harder at it, you could go on and make more. But you was required to get production. If you couldn't, why, you'd eventually be replaced.
How would they set the amount of work that you had to do?
Well, they have time study people that study how much of a loom is supposed to run in 8 hours, and you expected to run that much.
Did that change, say, in the 20s and 30s?
That's still changing. Only thing now that, because I haven't been in the mill in a number of years, but the only thing now is the machines have been speeded up. They run much faster, and you run a lot more machines too.
Would it be true that you weren't going weren't pushing yourself quite as far? It's hard back in the earlier days.
Well, you probably wasn't pushing yourself as hard, and you wasn't pushed as hard by the company. I mean, you were pushed, but not, I guess you'd say, to the extreme like you are now. Now you have too many people pushing the pencil behind you, and everyone's pushing that pencil is pushing you too. So you got all M&S and men and all that, you know. And
what's that stand?
Method and standard. Now I haven't I'm behind too. I haven't worked in the mill in 25 years, you know. But now they'll stand there and figure how long it takes you to tie a knot, how long it takes you to draw that thread in after you tie the knot, and all of they've got it down now to fractions almost.
Were they doing any of that when you came?
No, they didn't. They didn't start that till about time out a while before I came out of the mill. But
do you remember some of the first people that would have been those sort of people that came into the mill to look? Would they look at what you're doing, or in the 30s, or?
No, not then. They wasn't that. They didn't push that much then. They pushed too, but they just pushed by talking to you or urging you and telling you you'd have to get more production. But now they push you and then prove it to you.
Mm-hmm. What about any effects on people's health that might have had?
Well, I don't know. That'd be hard to say. You know, most of the people back in the older times live a lot longer than they do now, so I don't know whether these modern conveniences and all this technology is helping us any or not. Just like my father lived to be 82, her father lived to be 89, and they didn't push themselves like people do now, you know. So I think that maybe it's, you have some advantage and some disadvantage with all this modern technology.
Were there any cases in which folks who were working in the mills were unhappy at all with their circumstance, or would do anything to?
Well, if you ever seen a group of people that everybody was happy. Well, there's always somebody dissatisfied, regardless of the circumstances.
Well, people keep telling us how much they liked, you know, working and doing these jobs, but there must have been.
Well, you always got somebody a bitching too.
Yeah. Well, why? What would be?
Well, there's some people you can't please. I don't care if you give them a moon, they want the sun too. So some people you can't please. So a lot of time it's not because they wasn't getting a fair shake. After they got a fair shake, they still wasn't happy. You see what I mean? Some people can be satisfied and contented with a lot less than others. I mean, that's just nature, I think.
Well, now, there was that one time that in the plant mill where there was some trouble that we've heard about, you know, on several occasions, that famous dynamite.
Go to court about that.
Mm-hmm. Could you talk some about what you remember about that?
Well, really, we would go to Danville about every week. We'd go over to her parents in Danville, and there were several people from Danville that was working at Plaid Mill and other mills here in Burlington. Mm-hmm. And we'd go home every week. Mr. DeLong, he lived in Danville for years and years and worked over here, and he'd go home every week. And we rode with him a long time. A lot of weekends, we didn't go every week, but a lot of weekends, but after we got a car of our own and started going on our own, we were going to Danville this weekend, and the lady that came with Betty and I to Burlington when we came over here, she says she was going with us, and she told us, said this can't think of the man's name now, said he wanted to go ride with us to Daniel Duke. So he went with us, and we went on Friday evening after we got out of work and came back Sunday evening. Well, Saturday morning is when the meal was dynamited. That was during this strike. I don't remember, I believe they struck at that time. But anyway, well, this man had went with Danville, well, eventually one that was charged with dynamiting the mill. So when he came to trial, he had me for a witness to try to prove that he wasn't in Burlington on that weekend, that he was in Danville. So I had to go to court and testify that he went with rode with us to Danville on Friday and came back Sunday. I couldn't say what he did during that time because I didn't see him, but I was a witness to verify that he went with us to Danville and on Friday and came back Sunday. So it was a lot of ill will during those things. You know, they bring on a lot of ill will.
But he was convicted.
I'm not sure. I believe he was. I believe he was. It seemed like he got. Seemed like he got 2 years for that. I'm not sure.
They didn't. They figured he came back in.
Evidently they. You could very easily come back to Burlington in an hour or so, you know. And that wasn't enough evidence to prove that he wasn't here, because he went Friday and. This was did Saturday morning, and he came back Sunday. So, of course, I was a witness to try to help him prove that he wasn't here, but evidently it wasn't enough evidence. And they may have had other evidence, too.
Well, what were the reasons why that would have led them to do something like that?
Well, I really don't remember now, but you still have those things to happen now when you have a strike, you know, while you read, well, there's shooting and dynamiting, and especially on these truck drivers things, you know, going in and out of plants. You still have that. Anytime you have a strike and all, if it lasts very long, you're going to have some trouble and violence along with it.
Well, what was the cause of the strike to begin with?
Well, just like it's always been, I guess. Better working conditions and more money, and they felt like if they could force the company to give them more money and better working conditions. Because that's just like I said a while ago about people being satisfied. You can't give anybody enough to satisfy them, because if you give them one thing, they're gonna want two things, and it's just a snowballing thing. But that's your. It's working conditions, and sometimes they do get bad enough that you just have to do something to try to better the condition.
Mm-hmm. Well, about how many of the folks who were in the mill at that time were in support of that strike?
I couldn't really say. It was some that worked us all the time. I mean, it wasn't 100%. And that's where you bad feelings and your violence comes in at people going through people some out to gate of picketing, and then people come going in and coming out, you know, and that's when it gets real nasty. You know, back then everybody was out on strike, just about it would be at the gates, but now you're limited to so many that can picket. But back then you were on your own. Everybody that wanted to come to the gates and picket and those slurs and everything else, that the ones that were working while they did. And sometime it just got real nasty. But I think that strike lasted about maybe two or three weeks, something like that.
Well, what did you all do during this time?
We stayed out of work about, I think we stayed out a week. And of course, we was young and we didn't know probably what to do, but I think we stayed out about a week, and we'd seen that we were just losing time, and it wasn't going to amount to anything, really. We wasn't going to get anything out of it, so we went back to work.
Did you all ever come out on the picket line?
We, most of the time, we would stay at home. We could stay at home and see just about, about 2 blocks from the mill, you could just about see what was going on at the mill. And we didn't get involved in it too much.
Well, now, who would have been the people who organized or tried to organize that strike?
I don't remember who it was. I think it was American Federation of Labor was about the only all we had. We didn't have the CIO and all these. I don't know that how many of them is now, but we just, it wasn't but one labor organization in there. And of course, I think this was more or less a local thing anyway.
Were there particular people who were here in the working in the mill who were the trying to get the union going, or were people sent in from outside?
I think it was mostly local, just trying to get the people to go together and try to get something done. But you don't, your chances are real slim on something like that, because as a rule, the people working can, most of the people was more or less a week to week, a payday to payday thing, and you can't stay out very long. Mm-hmm. In other words, the company can stand it a lot longer than you can, so they just break you down.
Did that happen some in this case?
I think we stayed out about 2 or 3 weeks, but we wasn't out long enough to be in a big thing. Now, they had a strike in Danville before we came to Burlington back about 1930. And that thing went on for about a year, and they stuck it out a long time, but I think the company finally forced them back to work, but they've got the upper hand. Of course, now you've got your labor organizations that if you have a strike here, that the labor organizations will give support to you while you're out, but back then you were just on your own. You were just losing time, that was all. And you couldn't stand to lose time very long when you were just making barely a living wage anyway.
Were there any meetings of all those people that would have been out on the strike? Would they get together and try to plan some
strategy? Oh, yeah,
they
had meetings and all. And
where would they be held?
I don't really remember now, but you didn't have, as a rule, you didn't have two intelligent people leading those things. A lot of times you just had your loudmouth people. They had more mouth than they had intelligence. You didn't usually think you didn't have very good leadership.
Well, what happened then after the strike was over? Did the people that were involved in it, the strikers, did any of them come back to work in the mill?
Most of them did. Some of them they wouldn't take back, more or less the leaders and all. Some of them they wouldn't take back, but most of the people went back to work. And you didn't accomplish anything, really.
And did their hard feelings remain?
Well, yeah, that creates hard feelings. Even from a one worker to another, you know. Like, you come out and I stay in. Well, you are scared and everything else, you know, if you keep working and you're not helping, trying to help us better the conditions and all, you know, and that's where your hard feelings come in. It can get real nasty. A lot of people will get mad because the other person don't agree with them, you know. Was they're right and you're wrong, and they get mad because they think you're wrong.